great. It's another bass podcast.
Hi there, Sam. We're back.
Hi there, Eric. We are back indeed.
It's been 6 months since episode, was it 7, 8? I can't.
I think it was 5 even.
5, yeah, maybe it was 5. Yeah, let's not overdo it. And we did a pretty good episode then. We had Amos from Tesseract as a guest. And people seem to enjoy that episode. And then we haven't done anything since then. And but now we're doing something. And I mean, I guess the goal behind this podcast was never to make it like a weekly thing or but maybe like once a month, I think we said when we got started. Maybe that's a good thing to get back to, I guess.
Yeah, indeed. And then things happened and we've been both busy.
Yeah, super busy.
Life happened, as we say.
Yeah, life. Life tends to get in the way of things like podcasts and, you know, stuff. But now we're back.
Yep.
With a vengeance.
Yeah, to our one big fan. This is your all you're doing, so to speak.
Yeah,
So what is new since I think we did the last episode late August, if I remember correctly?
Yeah, late August, early September, something like that. We had COVID in the family, so my wife was downstairs with a fever. She had both kids, and it was an interesting experience, to say the least. It was September, I think, or late August, early September, the released episode. And I mean, there has been a NAMM since then.
Oh yeah.
So nothing life-changing has been presented, I think, since last time. I mean, there hasn't been anything that has made the community go bonkers, if you will.
Mm. Well, I mean, we're going to discuss the topic anyway, but I think, like, instrument prices in general are just insane right now.
Yeah, yeah. Inflation and everything like that has really made things.
Yeah, I mean, you see used Japanese copies of, you know, Fenders and that kind of stuff going for, you know, in levels they used to. You could find Fenders, like actual USA Fenders, for those prices. Yeah. Like, people are asking. I mean, some people are just asking crazy prices, and that's another thing. But in general, just prices in general are so bad right now.
Yeah, indeed. And I mean, it's supply and demand is one thing, and then there is the inflation. And yeah, and I mean, considering those old or older Japanese instruments, I think people are actually noticing how great they are as well. So I mean, that's also a factor to keep in mind, that I mean, the Fernandez and Hosco and all of those older, like, 70s basses are pretty darn good. So I mean, I mean, pricing is always a hard thing to discuss, because if someone is willing to pay it, then it's probably a price, right? Ain't it? I mean,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, those Fujigen and Matsumoku, they're really good instruments, no doubt. But I mean, it's just the overall prices. I mean, I remember, you know, the Squire Japanese Vintage, the JV series of basses. For those not in the know, Squire did a limited run during a few years during the 80s. They call it Japan Vintage or JV, and they're really high quality basses. I remember them going for 5,000, 6,000, like when I was in high school, and now they're going for over 10,000. So, just as an example.
And I mean, at my old job, we had an old Japanese made Fender Strat from, I think, 88. I think they were made in the same factory as the Squire ones, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong, don't quote me on that. But I mean, it was an amazing guitar. It was beat up beyond beyond salvation, but it was an amazing guitar. And I mean, if someone is willing to pay it, then it's probably worth it. But it's I mean, it's hard to see. I mean, wasn't it just a few days ago that someone posted like a Rickenbacker replica or copy or what have you for like a pretty high amount of money in the Swedish base group? Yeah. And people were freaking out by how can you ask this much?
Yeah. I mean, basically you used to be able to get like a classic Rickenbacker for 15,000 maybe. Now they're like, oh, a new one costs like 30, 35.
Yeah, and I mean, I borrowed one a few years back. Me and my buddy Lucas, we traded bases. He borrowed my Dingwall 5-string for a recording, and I got to borrow his Rickenbacker. And I mean, it's a cool instrument, but I would never, I would never pay that amount of money for that bass because it's not my thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't suit me, but. Yeah.
Yeah, the double truss rod, that's impossible to adjust correctly.
Yeah, and I mean the bridge and the pickup covers and all of that. I mean, it just doesn't resonate with me. It doesn't work with my technique and the way that I play. I've been playing a P bass for over 20 years now, so it's it's bound to have some impact on my playing style.
Was it Midnight Blue though?
Yeah, that one, it was Midnight Blue. It was Midnight Blue. That's also an inside joke. For those of you listening, there was a guy... Oh, you can tell the story.
Yeah, there was... I think it was 7-ish years ago. We were having a discussion, or maybe a discussion, that's the wrong word. But a thread popped up on the Swedish Talk Bass Equivalent Facebook page. Think someone had been very drunk. Yeah. And this guy was asking for if anyone had a Rickenbacker for sale, and it specifically had to be Midnight Blue. And people just kept like trolling him and egging him on, you know, to absurd results. And it's become a meme in Swedish bass player circuits.
Yeah, and he misspelled Midnight Blue.
Yeah.
Blue. Yeah, it was... if you're listening, sorry for making fun of you, but it was pretty hilarious. Don't drink on Facebook, guys. Don't drink on Facebook. It's, I mean, that usually pops up on Fridays. It's pretty fun when like you get that Friday thread when someone is a bit too drunk and starts posting about, you know, controversial.
Yeah, or there was a guy with the Dremel who tried to route his new pickguard on a Friday evening. to say the least, it didn't work out.
No, that did not work out. Oh, poor guy. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, guys, don't drink and Dremel.
Yes. And so, have you been listening to anything in particular lately?
I mean, I'm a big audiobook sucker, as you know, and I actually managed to get tickets to Mr. Yngwie J. Malmsteen. In Uppsala this summer. I figured I've never seen him live, and you never know when he's coming back or if he's coming back to Sweden.
Yeah.
So I actually bought a ticket for me and one for Mr. Emil, who's a drummer in 6 Feet Deeper.
Nice.
So we're going, and I was like, yeah, I should probably do some research. So I actually bought the Anders Tegner's unauthorized biography about Yngwie, and it was a pretty sad listen. I mean, at first it was funny, all of the like stupid things they did, but then just got sad. So I've been listening to that in terms of books, and then the new Bruce Dickinson album, the Mandrake Project has been floating around in my AirPods. No, well, yeah, headphones.
Yep.
And I mean, nothing. There are no like big like, oh, this album is amazing moments. I mean, I've been enjoying that album, but no, like, you need to check this out as of now. So yeah, what about you? Any new music that you've discovered?
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, did they mention anything about Svante Henriksson in the?
Oh yeah. It was like everyone was featured, so it was up until like 2011 or something. So lots of people.
Nice.
Going by.
Well, I mean, I've been listening a lot to Caligula's Horse. Yes, yeah. That is the band name. Absolutely.
Great band.
Yeah, fantastic progressive metal rock band from Australia. That I might. It's funny because the my first reaction to them was, oh, this sounds a bit like Carnival. And I mean, there is obviously the Australian connection there, but they just released their album called Charcoal Grace. Quite a nice album, quite melodic, a lot of sweeping arrangements, you know, like I'd describe it Mahler-esque, maybe. you know, these big soundscapes and combined with heavy riffs and chugging, and it's just a great album. They have like a concept thread going through the album with a suite of songs that, you know, translate really well to the album. And it's also a lot of like contemplative stuff, not just heavy, like very, very slow melodic stuff. My absolute favorite track on the album is actually Sails, which is a ballad, and it's absolutely amazing, and great production, fantastic sound in general, and just very competent musicians and who know what they do, and their sense of scale and ingenuity is quite nice.
Nice.
So that's basically what I've been listening to.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the regular Eddie Medusa, of course. Yeah.
Mera brännvin.
Precis. Ben, and we touched on the subject, and since this is the return of the podcast, we're going to focus a bit more on one singular topic today. And I want to begin with the most controversial. What's the point of having expensive instruments, really? I mean, it's a topic that's probably will be discussed hundreds of years after we die, because there's no consensus on it. And I don't know. That's at least here in Sweden, there's a like a weird sense of pride. I don't know how to describe it, but people are so obsessed with, oh, I took this 2,000 Swedish crown bass and turned it into a bass that's better than any Fender, and so on and so on and so on. And I mean, don't get me wrong, it's fun to mod basses, it's fun to improve your basses, and there's nothing wrong with it, but I think the discussion is very skewed because you rarely get anywhere with it.
No.
Because people are dead set in their, you know, ways, and people don't really change, you know. If there's one thing you should learn about people, it's people don't change. Opinions change, but people don't. So, you know. And again, for me, to begin the discussion, for me, it's... I think, to me, it's a lot about psychology, you know. If you've been playing for a really long time, you tend to pick up on the small details that make the difference in an expensive instrument. You know, things like, you know, the neck pocket on a bolt-on instrument, the fret ends on a fretboard, the ease of adjustments, like adjusting the truss rod, adjusting the string height, and so on. Those things are really easy to do. And just in general, the whole feeling of playing an expensive instrument. And not to say that there are expensive instruments that feel like shit, because I've had those as well.
Sure.
higher price doesn't necessarily, you know, mean a better instrument in all cases. But what I'm getting at is, I feel I've been playing bass for almost 30 years at this point, and when I pick up a bass, I can instantly tell, you know, in my hands, oh, this feels cheap, this feels expensive, this feels good to play, and so on. And again, it's not always about the setup or, you know, the string height, the string action. It's sometimes you just get that feeling, overall feeling of, oh, this is a good instrument, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there is something about weights that I've been thinking about, because I think someone posted about this a few years ago, that there is this ideal weight that a cheap instrument It's either too light or too heavy. It never has that perfect balance. Then again, there are expensive, very expensive instruments that are very light and very heavy. So that's not an idiot-proof concept. However, I think that there is something to like the balance of expensive instruments that come through in that regard. Another thing that I've been thinking about, you know, regarding expensive instruments, there is this podcast called Ultimate Guitar Gear here in Sweden. Mm. It's in Swedish, so. But they talk about the curated experience about buying, you know, boutique gear and expensive instruments. And there is something to that as well, I guess. I've never ordered a custom instrument or, waited for anything. I think all of my basses are pretty much bought secondhand.
Yeah.
in a way. Or like the case with my Attitude Limited 3, I never got the hard case and the case candy and anything like that. Because the guy I bought it from, he bought it from Thorman and they kept everything. They just sent the bass. and they kept like, I don't know why, but yeah. So with that being said, when I got this bass yesterday, I got myself a new Yamaha Attitude Limited 2 in Lava Red. I actually got the hard case and the case candies. That was a nice experience to get. But to get back to the subject, there is something about that aspect, you know, the curated experience about buying boutique gear that you don't get from buying a CNC made bass that comes in a cardboard box.
Yeah.
That being said, I mean, you can make... I don't know. You remember that I got a bass from my colleague. He found it in the dumpster in his home.
Yeah.
I think it was a Rusta boss, the Swedish warehouse. It probably cost about 1,000 Swedish crowns, which is about $100, I guess, when it was brand new. And you probably got an amp and a cable and stuff with it. He found it in the dumpster and he gave it to me. I was like, hey, I found a bass. Can you do something with this? And I cleaned it up. I did a setup, and it plays pretty darn good. It sounds okay. The things that I noticed when I was setting it up was that, I mean, the tuning pegs were terrible. I had to it took me like 30 minutes to get the strings to sit in the tuning pegs because they were jumping around. So it was a terrible. The hardware was terrible, and that is something that you can notice pretty much instantly with that cheap instruments, that the hardware tends to fail pretty soon, actually.
But it's interesting because you mentioned the whole purchasing experience and how, you know, the case candy and, you know, the accessories. And I mean, the internet is obsessed with the unboxing experience.
Yeah.
So, I mean, again, yeah, you know, just the first moment of tension and excitement when you receive, you know, the gig bag or the hard case, and you just, there's always like a special smell.
You know
it smells like, oh, new instrument, like new car smell.
Do you remember, were you a part of Club Nintendo here in Sweden?
I was a Sega child growing up.
There was this for those listening, there still is the distributor for Nintendo here in Sweden, Bergsala AB, had a club that you could join for free or pay very little money for, and you could, you know, you got a magazine like 3 times a year or 6 times, it varied, and you could call in and get help with the games that you were stuck in, and they always did an April Fool's prank, or maybe it was Super Play, a different gaming magazine, I can't remember.
Yeah.
One of them, anyways, did that. Nintendo were releasing an add-on for the GameCube that was supposed to send out smells. So when you were playing Mario Kart, you would smell the burnt rubber, and when you were playing like Zelda, you would smell the forest. So, I mean, one day there will be an iPhone add-on that will add the smell of the unboxing for you.
And the technology already exists. I've seen this. It just, the problem is you just have to have like chemicals, because I mean, smell is all chemicals, and you have to have chemicals they have to refill, but it's possible. And no, but getting back to instruments and
no,
it's perfectly fine. I mean, we are going deep here. No pun intended. Because we are playing bass and we always go deep. The whole experience and just knowing the fact that you have like an exclusive instrument, I think, for me at least, makes a difference. And I bought a used German Bill Sadowski. For those of you who know, Sadowski is one of the most legendary brands of all time when it comes to bass. Originally from New York City, Roger Sadowski, fantastic luthier, obviously. But during the pandemic, he decided to move pretty much his entire production except his New York custom shop to Warwick's factory in Germany, Markneukirchen. And I have one of those instruments, and like you instantly picked up on the quality. Again, the attention to details, you know, the flawless finish, everything in its place, the fret ends. Warwick has something called invisible fret line technology or something like that. Basically, their fret ends are invisible. You know, you literally don't see or feel them. And the neck pocket, I mean, I'm not kidding when I say you couldn't fit a hair in the neck pocket. And, you know, everything from the tuning pegs, which are OEM hip shot clones, basically, to, you know, the knobs they use to for the pickups and the preamp, everything just feels, you know, well built and thought out. And again, it's the attention to detail. The prices for them new right now are around like 38,000-40,000 something. I bought mine for 25, I think. And again, once you reach that level and start to go beyond $2,500, the difference, I mean, the law of diminishing returns, so to speak. At a certain point, you know, the difference is so minute you won't notice it anymore. But again, in your mind, you'll feel more comfortable with an instrument, or at least I do. And I think that's a big part of, you know, that experience.
Yeah, I mean, you said something. I think you put the nail on the head there. Like, when you go past a certain point in terms of pricing, you really can't tell the difference between a 2,500 euro bass and a 3,000 euro bass. I think that's a very valid point to make. Like, once you go past a certain point, there is very hard for someone to tell the difference. Mm. And
so to turn it on, said the discussion, we talked about this, people buying, you know, you often see this, oh, how can you pay 40,000 for a bass when there's good basses to be had for a quarter of the price? And then you see people like modding cheap, you know, China instruments with new pickups and new, you know, bridges and everything like that.
I think that has to do with
Jantelagen.
I think people, that's one aspect, but I also think that it's the people are afraid is the wrong word, but you know, you don't want to bring out your very expensive bass.
Mm.
To your gigs. I think that's a fear that some people actually have, and it's totally valid. I totally see that.
Of course.
I mean, I bring out all of my instruments to a gig, except for the Attitude Limited one that I've got, the Thunder Blue one, because it's a one of a kind instrument. Yeah. That's, I mean, the affection value, is that the word?
I think we call it sentimental value in English.
Yeah, sentimental value. Yes, thank you. It's so damn high on that bass that I can't see myself bringing it out and giving it, you know, dents and stuff like that, because it's so unique.
Yeah.
It used to hang, for those listening, this bass used to hang in one of the best music shops here in Stockholm for close to 20 years. It hung on the wall. And they went out of business back in 2019, and I actually got to buy it. I had seen it for 12 years, I think, when I first moved to Stockholm, like walking into that music store, I saw it on the wall. I was like, oh my God, that's so cool.
Yeah.
And I got to buy it. I mean, I've used it live. It's a great instrument, but I figured I'm going to use it just here in the studio because, I mean, if any of my other instruments were to get stolen, it would suck.
Sure.
I mean, I guess my old Fender P has got the same sentimental value, but I'm not bringing that to pub gigs and stuff like that. It's for nicer gigs or sessions. But yeah, I mean, all of the other instruments, it would suck, but they can be replaced to some extent. This one can't. So that's why I also got this Limited 2.
Nice.
Because it's very similar to my Limited 3. So I got, you know.
And I mean, I get the fact that you don't want to bring your expensive instrument to gig. But on the other hand, if you're a professional musician, that's expected of you. I mean, the risk of getting your equipment stolen will always be there. I mean, I have slight OCD when it comes to my instruments. If I don't like have physical contact with my instrument or sit within like a meter from them, I have to constantly check them. But yeah, I mean, I've had custom instruments and I brought them to shows. Some people are like, oh, how can you bring your custom instrument to a show? Was like, well, it's my custom instrument. That's the entire point. Like,
it's a tool.
Yeah, it's a tool. And I mean, we have smoke-free bars in Sweden since almost 20 years at this point.
Yeah.
So the bass won't, you know, physically degrade in that way.
Reek.
Yeah, exactly. I remember. I mean, I'm old enough to. I turned 18 right a few months before, or like a month before the ban on smoking was out. So I still remember coming home smelling like an ashtray.
Yeah, I was. I turned 18. You're born in 86,
yes.
Right? Yeah, so I'm 2 years younger than you, so I never got to experience that.
That's great. And I can understand, like, in the U.S., people being bringing so-called beater basses to, like, pub gigs and that kind of stuff, because in some states you can still smoke in bars. But again, if my custom instrument got a ding, I was like, so what? It's my instrument, and those are battle scars.
Exactly. And I mean, it's the same with cars. No one will, I mean, of course, there are people who buy cars and just keep them in the garage and never drive them. But, and I mean, that's fine. If you want to do that, if you want to buy a custom instrument and keep it in your home, then I mean, it's up to you. But to me, it's a tool that you need to use or that you should use and bring out on the road, and I mean, that's why they are made.
And so for me, there's another aspect, and honestly, like, I've never been well situated with economics until very recently in my life, basically. And for me, the possibility of buying something expensive, you know, saving up and having funds and just it's kind of like, for me, it's kind of like a point of personal pride in some ways.
Yeah, I get that.
After living like, because after I graduated from university, I had problems getting jobs. So at one point I had basically $100 after expenses was paid to live each month. So I've been at the bottom of the bottom, you know, and worked myself up, and now I'm in a pretty comfortable position when it comes to finances. But again, I'm like, I'm honestly considering spending like 6,000 euros on a bass. And I mean, that is a hell of a lot of money, but again, once you reach a certain point in your musical journey, so to speak, you know what you like, you know what works for you, you know the kind of instrument that would like help elevate you to new heights, and I don't know. It's
I mean, if you want it and you can afford it and it doesn't hurt anyone,
yes,
why not buy it? I guess that's the point.
Exactly.
And I mean, it's your money.
Mm.
And if someone goes, "Oh, you shouldn't spend that much money on a bass." Why not? What am I supposed to spend it on? Cocaine and prostitutes?
Yeah, because, I mean, exactly. And
because that's illegal.
Yeah, exactly. And for me, it's, you know, it's either a vacation or a new PC or a new bass, and those are the three things. And honestly, I'm fine taking a vacation in Sweden. I mean, I have everything I want in Sweden when it comes to vacation. So I mean, especially since I'm living single and I'm not traveling with anyone, like, I'd like to visit some places, but going there alone is just, you know.
Yeah, totally get that point.
And I'll have a nice base instead that I can enjoy for years to come, so.
Exactly. And I mean, expensive instruments are also an investment, I guess you could.
Yeah.
There is always that aspect. I mean, it's always sad to sell instruments. I had to sell bass to get this one that I'm currently sitting with. And I did a setup of it before, you know, sending it off. And I filmed a just short iPhone video to the guy who bought it just to show what the controls did. And I was like, oh, I don't really want to part ways with this bass. Oh, it's so damn good. But hey, you got to do what you got to do. And instruments are always an investment, I guess.
Did you sell the Dingwall?
No, I sold the black parts Fender.
Oh, okay.
The one with the Mirek pickguard.
Mm.
It was really sad to sell it, but it was the only one that I could sell to motivate to sell, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't sell the old Fender. I can't sell that because I will get haunted by my uncle. And I don't want to sell the Super P because it's a great instrument and I use it. So I figure, okay, I'm not using this bass as much as I want to and should. And it deserves to be played. It's such a great bass.
Yep.
Might as well, you know.
And
let's not play.
Yeah, again, you know, we're not saying you'll become a better bass player just by buying like a very expensive instrument, but again.
But you are.
Yeah, basically you are. I mean, a carpenter who doesn't sharpen his tools, who doesn't have the best tools, will have a harder time, you know, doing his job. An electrician that doesn't have the right tools, you know, will have a more difficult time doing his job. And again, you wouldn't put an old Volvo 745 in an effort race. F1 race, right?
No, and then again, I mean, you can always make things work, like a carpenter or an electrician. I mean, you can always make things work, and it's the same with sheep instruments.
Yep.
You can always make them work, and we're not talking about making them work. And I mean, like I said, the sheep Rustabas that I had or had,
yep.
I keep it at work, actually.
Nice. 'Cause
it's. I mean, it plays great.
Yep.
It took some setup and some work, but it plays great and it works. But would I bring it out on a tour? No, because it would fall apart. and that's the thing with sheeper instruments, because there is always a compromise with sheeper instruments.
Of course.
In terms of wood and like the carving of the body and the neck, those things are pretty darn solid these days, because you got the CNC machines doing the work and they do amazing. I mean, CNC manufacturing has made sheep instruments way better. I mean, when we were growing up, like the sheep Squire basses that you could get, I mean, they were shit back in like the early 2000s. They were like terrible. However, these days, sheep instruments can play really darn good and like feel really darn solid. However, there is always a compromise somewhere.
Yes.
And maybe the compromise is in like in the bass itself, like in the electronics or the hardware or in the labor. And that is always something to keep in mind. Like,
yes,
because nothing in this world is cheap. and free.
Yes, and that was actually an aspect I was getting at, you know, the whole moral aspect. Yeah. I mean, if you buy a custom Fodera, you know the people building the base, they work under the absolute best, you know, circumstances possible in a working condition. Same with if you buy a custom Warwick from Germany, they have like literally the most state-of-the-art instrument factory in the basically in the world. Yeah. And you know the workers are well paid, you know they have their rights, their insurances, their expenses paid.
Same with Dingwall.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like the Super P, it's like amazing luthiers working there. You know that the guys doing the paint jobs are getting proper protection.
Yep.
Same with the Japanese Yamaha that I've got. Yep. They got two. Same there. Like the factory is amazing. I can't speak for like the human factor, like how. Mm. But I guess they are pretty darn well protected in terms of like, you know, breathing equipment and stuff like that.
Oh, sure.
But yeah, I mean, that's an aspect that you need to keep in mind when you're spending a lot of money on an expensive instrument.
Yeah.
Because the money is going somewhere and not everything is going into the pocket of CEO Gibson. Sorry.
yeah. And you have the classic triangle, cheap, good, or fast. Choose two.
Yeah.
And that is obviously the motto in this case. I mean, okay, so to put this argument on its other side, if you always think that like that, you will never be able to buy or use any product, basically, because any product where you pay a premium, you pay for the human suffering behind it, basically.
Yeah.
But again, because the thing that people don't pick up on is woodworking can be extremely toxic. There are some types of wood, some types of trees that have like trees that are literally like poisonous to you know inhale or to work
yeah.
with. You can get
sawdust and you get dust lung or whatever
absolutely.
It's called in English. I mean, I work with a lot of woodshop teachers who are coughing their guts out every day because of that. Yep. And that's important to like keep yourself protected from.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's never good to buy a clean conscience, but for me it feels better to know, oh, this instrument comes from a place that's, you know, treats their workers well on that aspect. And again, once you reach a certain point, if you're dead set on a sound that you can't get anywhere else, that's where the money comes in, so to speak. I mean,
yeah,
I've been on my musical journey now for, like I said, almost 30 years. I started playing bass when I was 10 or 11, and I'm almost 40 years old. Sad to say, the realization has hit me. exactly. Sad but true. For those who didn't get the inside joke, that's a good one. I lost my track. No, what was I talking about again?
Sorry. You've been on your musical journey.
Oh,
for,
yeah. No, and my first love of instrument was Warwick, and for some reason it's a love story I can't seem to shake. My mind always turns back to Warwick, even though there are things with Warwick basses like that I generally wouldn't like. Like we talk about this a lot. I like basses with wide string spacing, with a few exceptions. Warwicks tend to have very tight string spacing.
Yeah.
They're very heavy usually, and I tend to like lighter basses. So the sound they make is a love or hate thing, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So like you either love it or you hate it. But like there's just something about Warwick basses, and specifically their neck through models. I don't like their bolt on models as much, but there's a certain kind of magic when it comes to their neck through models, like their streamers, the thumb bass, obviously. And I don't know, it's at the end of the day, I always come back to Warwick. It's like you coming back to Yamaha, basically.
Yeah.
and it's, I don't know, it's part of it is obviously nostalgia. We're both kids of the 90s, so to speak. And yeah. Warwick basses in the 90s were quite good. And like,
they were the shit, if you will, in terms of, you know, at least, I mean, like they were the bases that you saw in magazines, and you thought like, oh my god, that's next level. Yeah. That's not.
And I have so many players I enjoyed when I was growing up, like Stuart Sender, you know, like Ryan Martini, Peanut. We have like Dirk Lans from Incubus.
Yeah, Marco Ietal on my behalf from Nightwish.
Oh, yeah.
It was huge. Like I was gassing for an Infinity for many years because of him.
Yeah,
because it was a huge influence on me when I it was like the reason why I actually started playing with a pick from time to time. Nice. Still haven't got that one down, but yeah. I try.
And then obviously like Jack Bruce. I mean, again, you hear so much about Warwick. Oh, it's just a high-tech brand, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, but their biggest artist was Jack Bruce, who's arguably known for a very traditional. And I remember seeing an interview with him in a Swedish bass. Yeah. Swedish bass or guitar magazine called Fuzz. Sadly, not around anymore. But he talked about his equalizer, and he had a he said my equalizer is just like my mood most of the time. It's very grumpy, so he has an inverted smiley face because he brings out the mids.
Yeah,
space. And it's funny because at the end of his career, he almost exclusively played fretless. And I mean, fretless typically is not something you tend to associate with rock music, except Bill Wyman obviously played the first fretless in The Who. So, no, Stones. Stones, I mean, too early. Yes.
It's too early for you, sorry.
Yeah. And again, those you don't expect those kind of bass players to use a quote unquote high tech instrument.
No,
but again, it's what you make of it. Some of my best bass tones ever has come from Warwick basses, and the classic. Oh, why don't you get a Fender after the gigs? And then I tend to answer with, oh, okay. So you saw the gig, like you came to see me play music. Did the bass sound good? I was like, yeah, of course. Was I playing good? Yeah, of course. It sounded great. So then, what is the issue?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just people wanting to have an opinion about stuff. It's the same with cars.
Yeah.
Like, my car gets me from point A to point B. You should have gotten a Volvo. Why?
Right. And
because...
Oh, yeah. I forgot John Stockman from Carnival.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously. Yeah. Fantastic bass player. And fantastic when it comes to, you know, exploring tone. And it's funny because on their first album, he pretty much had like a clean bass tone, not a lot of distortion. And then
and things went awry.
Yeah, and he basically became the originator of like heavily distorted bass tone and that kind of music. Because a lot of nu metal bands, because, I mean, Carnival kind of, they were pretty much a nu metal band in their first album. But a lot of nu metal bands played Warwick as well, so I think they got a negative like connection to a lot of people in the early 2000s.
Yeah, associated with the nu metal.
Yeah, like tone, Limp Bizkit especially.
Yeah.
What is this, Sam Rivers? What's his name?
Can't remember.
Great bass player, by the way. But a lot of nu metal bands used some POD, had a Warwick guy and. But it's funny because if you look at the 90s, you had bands like Fishbone, Lawrence, oh, I can't remember his last name, Fishburne or something.
Isn't it the actor?
Yeah, that's the actor. Oh, I'm mixing it up with something. But
Yeah.
Great bass player, played Warwick basses exclusively. And they tend to be used in a lot of different contexts, basically. They're very versatile basses. And I can understand why, you know, the five-string thumb is not for everyone.
No, it's
it has a unique sound. It has a unique look.
Yeah, and I think it's look mostly that people are getting off about.
People are very afraid of phallic-looking instruments.
Yeah, for some reason, you don't want to be seen with a penis in your lap. I don't know why. Must be something about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but... And, I mean, a good tool, a good bass, you can use for everything.
Yeah.
I guess that's one of the points that you're making with the Warwick comment. That, I mean, it's not just for, you know, nu metal, because that was a while ago. They are great instruments, and if you want to buy yourself a Warwick for your tax return, then you should do that.
Considering
if that makes you happy, because that's what life is about. Make yourself and other people happy, I guess.
And again, you know the old adage, you need to have a Fender in the studio because that's the only thing producers can work with. Here's the thing, kids. If you ever hire an engineer and a professional producer, it's their job to make your sound work, not the other way around.
Yeah, I mean, I think that stems from people coming into the studio with subpar instruments and the engineer actually having a P bass that is nicely set up, or a jazz bass, or what have you, because that they've had for years, that they know how to dial in. It's the same with the Sans amp.
Mm.
To me, it's
very vanilla.
It's vanilla. It's a buddy of mine said it best. It's the substitute sound, the vicaria use. I'm subbing in a metal band. I've got my Sans amp. Nothing against Tech 21 and nothing against the players who are using it. They work. They work great. Oh. It's not for me. It's not my cup of goat blood. And people they know how to use it and know how to work it. And I don't know where I'm going with this.
They made it work.
So, yeah, they make it work. And you keep that in mind when you're going into a studio, I guess. Like, make sure that your instrument is set up correctly, that it's intonated, that you got fresh strings. Yeah. Then you won't be needing to use the. Then you won't need to use the engineer's P bass. Yeah.
And that is another thing that I can get. But again, never be afraid to, you know, say, oh, this is my bass. This is how I want to sound. And I remember I did a recording a few years ago in a studio, and the producer kept pushing me. It's like, oh, you got to use the neck pickup. It's more bass, and he put me into an entirely clean preamp. And not just like, and it wasn't actually a bass preamp, it was a mic preamp. And generally mic preamps are designed to, you know, be full range, pick up, you know, it brought out all the treble regions in the bass that you literally have no use for. And I felt very uncomfortable because, like, no, this doesn't sound like me. And I'm sorry, but I brought my amp, I had my Aguilar amp with me. You know, I knew what my regular tone settings for the songs were, and they always sounded good in rehearsal. I knew they worked. So it's like, that recording never went anywhere. And I think that's because the engineer was too set in his ways, so to speak. To be fair, he was an educator as well. So there was like a studio school.
Okay.
So he'd probably been taught a certain way. And I mean, it is common to have a completely clean bass signal when recording bass, even if you have an amp. But again, in this case, it wasn't even a DI box made for bass.
It was a preamp.
Yeah, preamp. And it just brought out, you know, like the 10,000 hertz sounds, like
the fizzle
of like scratching a nail on a piece of glass, basically. And I was like, not to be that guy, but like, I'm a bass player.
Yeah, and I mean, that's another thing that you can always, you know, when you're doing a session, bring a DI box so that you can split your signal. If you're like me and you're using, you know, pedals and preamps on your board, make sure to have the option to send a clean signal to the engineer, because they always want that. Or, I mean, I'm currently working on the new 6 Feet Deeper album, and I'm doing the mixing. Nice. And I've recorded just a clean DI into the computer. I'm doing everything in the box because that's how I enjoy working with stuff like that. However, I could have just as easily recorded just my bass tone for my board because I know how it works and what it sounds like.
But it's also part, like you said, studio etiquette. It's disrespectful to your bandmates, you know, to the producer and engineer, because I mean you have a limited time in the studio. It's expensive to hire a proper studio.
Very much so.
Come to a session like completely unprepared is very rude, especially to your bandmates. And honestly, if you don't bring like fresh strings and another set of strings, you know, whatever you need to get the job done. And again,
don't go into the studio
because you're just wasting everyone's time, basically. Yeah. And
unless you're paying. I mean, if you're paying the bills yourself, go ahead.
Absolutely.
Waste everybody's time.
Absolutely.
If you're paying for everything. But no, that's terrible.
I mean,
to do.
There's a classic story about Stanley Clark and the studio once. He just brought his upright bass because he didn't expect the producer to ask him to play electric bass, basically. So he just brought his upright. And honestly, for me, Stanley Clark is a much more interesting on upright bass than he is on electric bass, but that's another story. But anyway, the story goes, he panicked because the producer didn't say anything about electric bass. So he just went out the studio on the streets. I think this was in Los Angeles. And it's like, he grabbed the first guy walking along who looked like a bass player with a gig bag. You know, it's like, and the guy was like, obviously, it's like, oh shit, it's Stanley Clark. Damn, I get to see like a legendary musician in the studio if I just borrow, like lend him my bass. So basically the guy had a Fender Jazz bass. It was poorly set up, completely dead strings, all the bad things, but Stanley brought it to the studio and he made it work somehow. So because I mean he had experience recording obviously, and but you can still hear it's Stanley Clark. But again, those are the exceptions. I mean, again, if you get Lee Sklar wouldn't be in such a situation because he's a perfectionist. Yep. but I mean, if those guys, Nathan East, you know, Will Lee, or if they got in that situation, they would make it work because they're just that professional.
Yeah, they sure are. I mean,
but most people aren't. Yeah. That's my point. Like most people that just play in a band in Sweden are amateurs and they have a day, a daily job they need to do. So again,
exactly,
if you have a good instrument, you know, oh, if it comes to it, I need to change something, like change the strings or the string height, or, you know, you can do that and not hurt the recording process.
Exactly.
So you know, basically an expensive instrument is kind of an insurance.
Yeah. So yeah, but to round things off, I guess, cheap versus expensive instruments. If you want to buy an expensive instrument and you want to invest your money in that, then go ahead.
Yep.
Because there is something about expensive instruments that you will, and there is always the buyer's, what's called?
Buyer's remorse?
The buyer's remorse, the other, when you like verify and justify your purchase.
Oh yeah, yeah, the endorphin release, or no?
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah. There's something bias. Okay, confirmation bias. Oh. There's the confirmation bias that you're like, oh, it's expensive, therefore it's great.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I mean, there is always the confirmation bias aspect of buying an expensive instrument. And again, we're not saying that cheap instruments are terrible.
No.
However,
they are.
Oh, we're getting canceled. Good job,
exactly.
Sam. Good job.
Yeah,
we're back on track.
We're not saying cheap instruments are bad, but
you get what you pay for, and there is always a compromise somewhere with a cheap instrument. I mean, sometimes you can find a local luthier who can probably build you an instrument for a bit cheaper than your than what it would cost to get like a more acknowledged and recognized luthier, yeah, like internationally. I mean, there is always that aspect you can always look into if you want to, you know, be it's not yeah, it's fair trade, right? Fair trade is the human rights. If you want to buy a fair trade instrument, then there are always options, or, you know, buy used instruments. Yeah. That's also fun. But again, there is always a compromise with a cheap instrument. It might be in the build quality, or it might be in the human aspect. Yeah. And this is not to shame anyone who buys a cheap instrument. But when you're planning on, like, I'm going to invest the money into a brand new instrument for myself, I want to invest money into this, keep that in mind. Like, keep in mind that there is always a compromise somewhere. Yep. With cheap new instruments, I should say, yeah, because you can make, I mean, if the instrument is over 40 years old, then you can't, you can't really think about the ethical aspect of something being built in the 80s.
And I can just, to end my segment on it, I mean, I'm a big gamer, I'm a big PC nerd, and I love, like, expensive keyboards, and but like the difference between an expensive keyboard when it comes, especially when it comes to typing feel, you know, the feeling and the sound of the actual you know, keycaps hitting the board, basically it's the same idea as expensive instruments.
I love that.
But to end on a positive note, we're going to try to keep this a bit more regular. We had some life happening in the background.
Yeah.
But to our only fan requesting more podcasts, there will be more. We promise.
And not on OnlyFans, but yeah.
Exactly. Our only fan, not our OnlyFans. But maybe we should start an OnlyFans with just
let's not
display, like, really expensive basses
and feet.
That's a good idea. Only feet and fan and basses, yes.
And not fanfret basses only, but...
Maybe we remove the pick guards of instruments to show them in the nude, so to speak.
Yeah, take off the strings one by one really slowly, like, look at this dirty,
unwind the tuning peg, like, really slowly. We do bass ASMR, bass setup ASMR. That's an idea.
Lots of cursing in that one. Oh, shit! good to be back, yep. Sam. Hopefully we'll have a new episode out next month or something like that. You never know.
We could start a Patreon, you know.
Well, that's a good idea.
That's an actual good idea. Anyway, Eric,
you don't get anything, but we can buy expensive instruments.
Yes, and like, if you want memes, that's what you get from me. But anyway, Eric, nice catching up, and hopefully we'll talk a bit in the future as well.
Yeah, we will. Take care, Sam.
Until next time.
Take care. Bye.